There is a certain movie-like quality to the unexpected twists and turns of Susan Schaller's life. At 17, she was hit by a runaway truck and had a severe concussion that forever changed her life and led her to an unconventional, deeply compassionate calling. For over 3 decades now, Susan has worked as an author and advocate, shining a light on a long-neglected and often misunderstood field. She is dedicated to raising awareness of the vital importance of language, the need for equal access to it, and how we all gain when we learn from each other, regardless of our differences. At 22, Susan stumbled into the role of a teacher for a 27-year-old man, deaf from birth, who didn't have a language and didn't know such a thing existed. He was thought of as a bit of a hopeless case. Fortunately, Susan didn't know that, and she threw herself into teaching this man day in and day out. What they were able to accomplish together is a groundbreaking story, one that gives you goosebumps. It's a story she told in her book, A Man Without Words, a book that the renowned Oliver Sacks urged her to write. There was no looking back. Susan's work continues to surge forward, and among other things, now encompasses retelling fairy tales with a modern twist for the multilingual platform ASL Tales, and working on a documentary version of A Man Without Words. I first met Susan in a serendipitous setting. It was at Karma Kitchen, and she was seated at the community table, and she was just beaming, because the place and its spirit and its intention all felt so right to her. Ever since, her resonance and friendship with the service-based community has been a joy and a blessing, and it's such an honor to have her here with us today in this way. Thank you, Susan, for being here and for being you.
Thank you, Pavi.
Well, we're really looking forward to this conversation and hearing more about your incredible journey. And I was thinking that a good place to start would be your doorway into working with American Sign Language and people who are deaf. It was an unusual doorway, to say the least, and as I recall, it began in a visual poetry class that you had snuck into. Can you tell us a little bit about what led you there and what that experience sparked for you?
Oh, good morning, everyone. It's so wonderful to hear all your voices, especially the ones that I have faces attached to. When I had the concussion, I couldn't read. My bruised brain was bruised at the part where the semantic connections were made, so I could read mechanically, but I couldn't get meaning until about the fifth or sixth try, which meant I was excused from all my classes. I was a senior in high school, and I was bored out of my mind because most of my brain worked, just that reading part was temporarily affected. And someone said, "Susan, nobody will know you're not a university student, so go to the nearby university and crash courses. It's so much more interesting than high school." So she was right. Nobody knew I wasn't a college student. And then one day I decided to try the drama building. That looked very interesting and new because I had played in orchestra all my school days, and so I was always in the pit. I was never on the stage, and so I didn't know anything about drama. And so I walked into the drama building, and I just picked the door at random. It was the first door on the left, and I walked in, and the professor was signing. Nowadays, that wouldn't be so strange. We have some deaf professors, and we have people signing lectures. But in those days, it had never, ever happened before, in far as I know, in the world. And I didn't know I had walked into history, but I could feel it. There were deaf people attracted to that class called visual poetry, and they looked like they had died and gone to heaven because they had never had a lecture in their language. And the interpreter was translating for the hearing students, so it was a hearing university. And because I heard the interpreter, I heard the English, I was freed to watch the signing. And it was, my first impression was that I was watching Vincent van Gogh painting in the air or Leonardo da Vinci. I just didn't want to blink. It was just pictures in the air, and then they disappeared, and then there would be another picture. It was just beautiful. And people say, why did you decide to learn sign language or work with the deaf. I never decided. You don't decide to fall in love with a poem or decide to fall in love with a piece of music. I just fell in love with this visual language, and I started meeting deaf people. And I really do feel that I had never seen. They see so much better than we do. The brain is plastic, so if you're born deaf, your brain forms differently. It takes up much more cortex for visual information processing. So they literally are superior to us hearing people in seeing, in processing and expressing visual information. And so compared to hearing people, they're geniuses in seeing. And to put it the other way around, back when I was 17, I felt blind next to deaf people. And they introduced me to a much richer visual world. They introduced me to eye contact, which I was a scared little nerd, so I was afraid of looking at people. And they introduced me to my body, to my face. So aside from the language, I feel like deaf people made me who I am. I am able to communicate better to everyone in the whole world because of deaf people.
What a tremendous beginning. My goodness. And so from there, that kind of sparked a more formal study of it and then led to that. Can we fast forward a bit to that first encounter with the 27-year-old whose life you would change and who would change your life?
When I walked into this room, I was hired to be an interpreter, an ASL. Well, this shows you how recently it's been accepted as a language. It was just called sign language back then. I was a sign language interpreter, and now it's called American Sign Language. And I'm not that old. It's been very, very recent, actually, hearing people that people have accepted sign languages as sophisticated whole languages and named them. So I was an American Sign Language interpreter. I walked into this class, and I thought that the registry had made a mistake because everyone was signing.
Mm-hmm.
And without going through all the details, I was ready to leave, and then I saw this man. And I want to skip to what attracted me most to this man, that in seeing him interact with people, I could see that he was very frightened. He was scared. He was holding himself as if in a straitjacket, but his arms were the straitjacket. He was just holding himself, hugging himself, really, and he was in a corner. And although he was very frightened, he was watching, and he was studying, and I could tell that he was studying everyone. And that's what attracted me most to him, because when I found out that he was languages later, I thought, I would have given up. He didn't know that sound existed because he was born profoundly deaf. And he thought we figured out what was happening on the mouse. I mean, he could see something was happening. He thought we figured this out visually. So he thought he was stupid. So thinking he was stupid for 27 years, he still kept studying. He kept studying mouths and trying to figure out what was going on. And I know I would have given up. And I've asked people, and most people would have given up and become, you know, sort of developed a kind of autism, you know, just a kind of craziness. And he, that amazed me more than anything. It still amazes me. So I was attracted both to his intelligence and to his quote, sanity. I mean, he didn't share our reality in a way, and yet he didn't give up trying to connect.
And it's beautifully described in the interview with Richard Whitaker in Works and Conversations, how you ended up having that brilliant idea to teach an invisible student, and that doing that day in and day out ultimately led to that breakthrough moment. And I can just imagine the electricity in the room, you know, when he was just pointing to everything when he discovered, when he discovered language. What a profound moment, and what a gift that you were an instrument for that in no uncertain terms. I'd like you to share maybe a little bit about, you know, in your experience, what people often talk about language as something that reveals our inner nature. And, you know, Steven Pinker, the Harvard psychologist, I think he went as far to say that human beings are verbivores, a species that lives on words. Can you talk a little bit about the significance and role of language in our lives? Because I think some of us, who've, you know, we tend to take it a little bit for granted.
We take it for granted, I think, all of us who have language from infancy, because we don't remember not having language. And having had twin babies, I can, and anyone who's been around children can see that they have language before they have an active memory. Before they can understand tomorrow and yesterday, they have language, the beginnings of language. And so that means that we have language before we have memory. And that's why we don't remember being languageless. So, so naturally, we take it for granted. And I want to jump to, in answer to your question, a main theme that I've been working on and trying to unify all of my life and all of my projects under this idea of we are affected by each other, and language, of course, is a big part of that storytelling, but other ways of connecting. And to just comment on what you said about me changing Ildefonso's life, Ildefonso changed my life, and we always change each other's lives. And language, as I said, is part of the mirror that we use, but we can connect in other ways. I'm very happy that Zach Godchild from Louisiana has joined us, because he has some very good ideas on a full-length documentary that talks about how language can also separate us, and that one of the things he loves about Ildefonso, he's met Ildefonso, and he filmed a short documentary this summer, and seeing how Ildefonso connects with people without language. So I learned an awful lot, and I'm still learning from Ildefonso how I can connect without language, and want to also point out one of the lessons that I learned recently. Is a new edition of my book, and it has a new chapter, Ildefonso's chapter, and it is nothing like what I intended to write or thought I was going to write. And I went down and asked Ildefonso to sign whatever he wants to tell the world, and I'll translate it. And again, not to go into too many details, he doesn't understand what I'm talking about because he's still not a part of the book world. He can't read. And so he says, that's, you know, basically, that's your world. You do whatever you want. So this is getting to your question about how language affects us and how words affect us. I said I could only write the book from my point of view, what kept me coming. I was so frustrated, and I know you were frustrated. We both showed signs of frustration, and I can only say why I got up every morning and came to meet you again, even though it was so frustrating. It was definitely the most frustrating thing in my entire life. And I said, but I can't say anything about your feelings and thoughts. I don't know why you showed up every day. Mm-hmm. And he said the most wonderful, wonderful thing. He said, I did understand a little bit of what you were doing. He said, I knew you were trying to tell me something. And I just thought that was absolutely wonderful, you know, that because I was trying to connect, he showed up and tried to connect.
And essentially showed up for each other,
And so again, you know, what Zach said about you can connect without language, that we do connect through smiles and through intention and through many, many ways.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he's so inspiring. And you
have a tradition of meeting up again once a year, I think, at least?
When I lived in Southern California, it was once a year. I'd always show up at least for his birthday. And now that I've moved to Northern California, it's not quite as often.
And how is he doing?
Well, I'd like to, if I could, have Zach describe meeting him, because that would give a fresh perspective and a more recent one. So if we could have Zach Godchild talk about his meeting of Ildefonso.
Sure, maybe, and I think because we'll have to change the mode of the call for that, maybe that can be done when we change into Q&A mode.
Okay, we'll just bookmark it.
Wonderful. We'll bookmark it for now. Perfect. It's incredible. I mean, I think that another thing that's hard for us to understand, and that I've read some of your descriptions of it through, you know, when you did an article on John Castle, maybe you can talk a little bit about, but just what it means to not have a language, you know, to not know that sound exists. Can you paint a picture for us of what that means at an experiential level as a child, and then, you know, growing up?
I was trying to, for years and years and years, I was trying to figure out how to communicate to the hearing world about my experience in a way that would change perception, that deaf people would be treated as equal, because in every culture, everywhere in the world, deaf people are not treated as equal. They can't get jobs. In many cultures, they can't get driver's license, which driving is visual. You don't need ears to drive. They can't get married. And horrible, horrible things are done. Mostly, they're kept from language. And I was trying to think, how can I communicate this? Because for decades, basically, I don't think my work has done anything in terms of, I mean, I hope I'm wrong, but the feedback that I've gotten is I haven't changed any policy. Things are getting worse for deaf people with the belief that we can cure them. Then they're kept from language even more, which is pretty ridiculous. I mean, they can be bilingual. Like, you could sign to your baby and have a cochlear implant, which doesn't make them hearing. It does help them with communication, but it doesn't make them hearing. So they could be deaf and hearing. They could, you know, I mean, they're not hearing, but they could be accessing the hearing world a little bit more with cochlear implants. But they're not going to be able to benefit from the cochlear implant until they're about 2 years old at the earliest. So, of course, you need to sign to them when they're babies. Anyway, I've been very frustrated. And so back to your question, I realized that the second book that I wrote about many languages people couldn't get it published, and I realized it was partly because of this filter. It's like I had to say why these people are languageless, how they became languageless, and as soon as the word deaf came up, it's like, oh, we've already written about disabled people this year. I mean, that was a common response from publishers. So the good news is that I started rewriting the book and thinking about the bigger issue, which is related to your question. What is language, and how does it connect us? And I realized that, forgive me if there's any anthropologist on the line, but I'm going to use the word tribe, and I know it has very specific meaning in anthropology, but we're tribal creatures, and tribes are language groups. Tribes are held together by language groups. So you have a family, extended family, and tribes. So there's, I did touch on it in my book, that there's an English-speaking tribe, and somebody that's not English-speaking, they don't see a difference between British people and Americans and Canadians. You know, they're English-speaking. Mm-hmm. And we're more tribal than we are national. That's always true. And so when we keep a deaf baby or any person from language, it's keeping them from joining the human community, because we join through tribes. You know, we're first part of a tribe, and then we're intertribal. And language is a key. It's a ticket. So if I have the English language, I have a ticket to the English-speaking tribe. If I learn Spanish, I have a ticket into the Spanish tribe. And so when we don't give a human baby that ticket, we're keeping them out of the human community. And nobody can be human alone. And yes, we can connect in some ways without language, but culture, so much of culture and all the storytelling, the stuff that we're doing now, why are we having a conference call? And we could all be emailing each other.
Yeah,
but we love stories. We love sharing stories, and we love real-time storytelling. And we know somewhere inside of us that we can't truly be human without each other. And so we're keeping someone from being fully human if we isolate that person. And deaf people are terribly isolated, because most of them are born to hearing parents, and it's really easy to keep them from language.
And I was just thinking, so much of our, I think somewhere in your description of Ildefonso's story, you talked about how he had to make up his own explanations for everything. You know, it was only what he could take in through visual clues. And so that's just such a poignant place to be in, to try and have to construct rules and, you know, logic and everything from by yourself and with literally no, I mean, I can't imagine how isolating that must feel, and to not have the power to express. It's just quite chilling to think of how many people might still be going through something like that, and it's such a light that you shine, you know, bringing these things relentlessly to the foreground, even in the face of kind of, you know, not the most, it's not an easy route, like you said, it's swimming, you know, upstream, but it's such important work. Can you, I'm curious to know, I mean, one of the things I've always found fascinating is how every language has certain words in it that are, you know, untranslatable into other languages and certain nuances that are unique to it. With ASL, are there certain things that can be communicated through that can't be really translated very well, or where it actually has the advantage?
Yes. Yes, as you know, anyone who knows more than one language knows that one language can say things so much better than another, and vice versa. And this is the thing about this tribal. If you think about let's say culture instead of tribe. If you think about a culture, and culture and language can never, ever, ever be separated. You cannot learn a language without learning something about the culture. Even a dead language, you can't learn Latin without learning something about Romans. And so culture and language are always together. And another way to describe culture is a set of stories. So a group of people share a set of stories. And the way that relates to what you're asking is different perception, a different perspective, I should say, so that you see the world slightly different. So the English-speaking tribe sees the world a little bit differently from whatever another language, and that's one of the reasons why some things are said so well in a language is a different perspective. And what does it say that the Hopis don't have a word for hate, and the Hopis don't have a word for war? I think we all should learn the Hopi language because there's something there. There's something there. And with all sign languages around the world, of course, visual things. There are so many idioms that have to do with vision and visual way of seeing the world, and those are very, very hard to translate into an oral language. And
is there an example that could illustrate it for us?
Well, in English we would say someone did a double take, and you know, that means something. But if you saw it in sign language, if you saw it's so much stronger. So you have something that a sign that represents a pair of eyes, and then because you're using space in all sign languages, you're using space and you're using movement. That when you're looking at something and then you look away. I'm signing as I talk, so it doesn't come across very well on the phone.
Great.
But I have two fingers pointing out, which now represent two eyes. And I look at something, I'm looking at Pavi, and then I look away, and then I realize that Pavi's wearing this gorgeous scarf, and I do this double take, and I quickly move back with my body and my head and my hand with the two pairs of eyes. But it's so quick, and it's so fast, and it's so much stronger. So it's really, there is no translation that's as strong as the sign. Double take is the best we can do, and it doesn't nearly show, you know, all the emotion that I had, and I, you know, and just I'm wowed by the sight, and it's because there's speed, there's movement, it's you know, and we're using space. So this, I'll give you another example that when we say the word Trinity, and then you're trying to describe, well, what does Trinity mean? And you say, oh, it means three in one. Mm-hmm. And when you do this in space and changing movement, so you have three fingers going into the other hand and coming out one, it's It's very dramatic. It's very dramatic, and it's so much stronger again.
Kind of a poetry in motion sort of thing, yeah.
And on ASL Tales, these multilingual fairy tales, there's a fairy tale, and the text is in English, and there's illustrations, so it looks like a normal fairy tale book. And then in the back there's a DVD, and you can play, you can see a deaf person doing the story, an ASL version. It's not a translation. It's doing what American Sign Language does best, and then English can write what it does best. And it's just exactly the same story, but a different version. And there's translations so that you can pick Chinese or Spanish, whatever your native language is, or English. And so you can be, all hearing people can listen, and hearing children can listen in their native language, and then be freed up the way I was when I had walked into that class and saw American Sign Language, but heard the meaning through the interpreter. And they can watch, and what you're talking about, things that can't be easily translated, little tiny kids see, for example, the sign for lonely. And they might have used the English word lonely, but a two-year-old's not thinking what that means as much as it might mean I want to go next door and play with my friend. You know, that might be the closest to the meaning. But they see the sign with the facial expression and one finger held close to the body with this lonely, sad look, and they get it all by myself. And so to change the perception from a problem, deaf people are problems, they're handicapped, they're disabled, they're not like us, they're missing something, to change that perception from a liability or from a problem to an asset, this is my dream. Before I die, all of you, I'd like you to help me. Before I die, I'd like to see hearing people, hearing classrooms, quote, normal classrooms, adopt American Sign Language storytelling as a tool for teaching literacy, for teaching cognitive tasks, and then specifically back to my example about lonely, in preschool, one of the main objectives all preschools have is, and parents, is to help kids identify emotions, because it's one step towards empathy, and it's related to communication and listening skills. And I've seen two-year-olds and three-year-olds get emotions, identify emotions because of what they see in American Sign Language that they didn't get from the word lonely, for example.
Wow.
And there's lots and lots of examples of what it could be. So it could be that, so anytime we see a person, whoever the person is, as an asset that we can learn from that person's story or that culture's story, set of stories, we are helping ourselves. We are growing as human beings.
Well, can you talk a little bit? One of the things that really fascinated me was how you point to how this is actually a more universal language. One of the problems that often happens with, that you hinted at, is that language in the conventional sense can often separate us and make dialogue more difficult. And that kind of barrier is much, you've seen it, and maybe you can give us examples of seeing that, you know, traditional barriers being kind of transcended more easily by people who have this finely honed mode of communicating with each other.
But I haven't read much, but I've experienced some universality of sign languages. For example, what I said about it's a completely different mode, and so when you're using vision instead of our ears, we use space, we use movement, we use shapes, and that is universal. And for whatever reason, the grammar based on the eye is not as flexible as grammar based on the ear. And what I mean by that is that it seems like, again, I haven't read this, but I've experienced it. It seems like all sign languages around the world follow chronology, whereas in English, I can say I saw a car accident on the way to work. I can say on the way to work I saw a car accident. You know, I can say it in lots of different ways.
Right.
But in American Sign Language, it follows chronology. First, I was going to work. A car accident happened, and I saw it. It always So the sign order is much different from English word order. I should say quickly that American Sign Language has nothing to do with English as far as grammar. And then back to your question. So I went to a human rights conference concerning deaf people and disabilities in Vienna, and I went early because I heard, this is put on by the World Federation of the Deaf, and I went early because I heard that they had no interpreters at the business meetings, and I wanted to learn something called international sign. It's not truly international. It's pretty much European-based, but any deaf person who goes to it does learn this set of vocabulary. It's also not a language, but it's a set of vocabulary. And this shows you that there's lots of universality between signs languages, because if you learn this set of vocabulary, you can communicate with anyone around the world as long as they're thinking in their signed language. So I could talk to a Japanese deaf person if that person was thinking in Japanese sign language, not Japanese, and I was thinking in American sign language, not English. Well, yeah, I can't do that. Even studying Japanese for 5 years, I can't do that.
Right. Oh, that is fascinating.
So if we truly, this is a big if, but if we truly wanted to be international, we would put deaf people on UN committees. Again, if we saw deaf people as assets instead of problems, liabilities. So a Japanese deaf person is Japanese and shares Japanese culture. And they also share a visual culture, a subculture, with deaf people around the world, signing deaf people. So a Japanese deaf person and a Ugandan deaf person can communicate after trading vocabulary for a couple hours instead of a couple decades. I mean, it's tremendous.
That just vaults over the barriers in such an astounding rapidity. My goodness.
It's very, very exciting.
You know, I want to backtrack a little bit because, you know, one of those movie moments I feel like in your life was the fact that you had Oliver Sacks writing the foreword to your book, probably one of the most famous neurologists of our time. And how did you come to cross paths with this legend? And what was he a strong influence on? Like, what was that? What was, because I remember reading that he was kind of very forceful about saying, you've got to write this book.
Well, I was continuing my interest in linguistics, just as a hobby. I didn't study it formally, but I was taking linguistics courses, and well, I guess some applied linguistics because I was teaching English as a second language for many years, and I was surprised when I started taking linguistics courses that people said if you don't learn language by the end of infancy or at the latest adolescence, it's impossible to learn language, your first language. And I thought, but this isn't true. And so I was very frustrated that I started writing anthropology journals. I thought anthropologists would be more open than linguists. And so I was writing letters and saying, it was basically like, excuse me, you should know about this. and I was telling the story about meeting it. Languageless man, and he did indeed learn his first language with problems. I mean, he has an adult brain,
yeah,
and his problems, but it's language. And and while I was doing this, someone showed me an article about Oliver Sacks wanting to write a book about deaf people as a linguistic minority, because as a doctor, he was trained that they're just deficient. They're just, you know, an absence of hearing is how he saw it. And he was fascinated by a culture and a whole group of people that came up with this beautiful visual world, and it was so different from the medical model. And I thought, oh, what a wonderful man. I had read The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and I thought, what a wonderful man to write about this. And so I wrote him a letter and said I would volunteer to be his interpreter in the Bay Area if he ever came out, and I would introduce him to some key members in the deaf community. And just because he was Oliver Sacks, I put in a paragraph, and, oh, by the way, I met this man, and I had this paragraph. And Oliver Sacks writes back and says, what? I want to hear more about this. Write this down for me. So I wrote down a little summary. And the funny part of this story, it's good to tell because I'm not the same person I used to be. Fortunately, I am more confident. But I used to have terrible, terrible ego problems. And I remember having this this writing in this envelope, and I was at the mailbox, and it suddenly hit me that I was sending some writing to Oliver Sacks, this wonderful scholar, this wonderful writer, and who was I? And I was too embarrassed to send it. And I'm at the mailbox, and it's all, you know, addressed and postmarked, and I mean, postage stamped on it, and I can't put it in the mailbox. And I remember so well opening the drawer of the mailbox and then shutting it, and I finally just had to close my eyes and drop it into the mailbox because I thought, oh no, and then he came out to meet me, and I thought this kind man was going to tell me, you know, to get a real job and that he had made a terrible mistake. And instead, he said, you must write this down in detail. And as I said, I had no confidence at the time at all. And I remember in my head, the very first thing that popped up in my head was, who am I to argue with Oliver Sacks?
Oh, great. So, well, what a mentor to have had. I mean, just that, you know, that encouragement. And
he became my research assistant. He was sending me stuff and calling me. And one time he called me and said, Susan, publishers hate me for this, but I really think you should have an academic line, which is the footnotes, and then, mm-hmm. you know, the storyline and the regular text. And he's all excited about this. And you bring up so many questions and about language and all these kinds of things. And there's so many academic questions you could be pursuing in the footnotes. And there was silence on my end, because I had been rewriting the first chapter about 30 times, still not having any confidence, not being able to move beyond it. And there was just silence for the longest time. And then I said, Oliver, I have no confidence.
Oh.
And then there was silence on his end.
His end.
And he said, I know.
Oh.
And the next letter he sent me, it said, Dear Susan, do not be discouraged. And I went out and I copied I enlarged the first part of the letter so it had Oliver Sacks' letterhead and it had Dear Susan, do not be discouraged. And I made a little poster and I put it above my desk. And so it wasn't just you know, the research assistant, he was my cheerleader. Back to the theme that I keep pushing to unify all my projects is we are affected by each other every single day. I mean, what mm-hmm. Zach said about the smile, you know, it affects us this whole day. And obviously our parents and our close friends, but everyone affects us. And I'm not Susan without Ildefonso, and I'm not Susan without Polly, and I'm not Susan without Karma Kitchen. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not Susan alone.
That is a beautiful, beautiful way of expressing it, Susan. You have a true, true gift, and I'm so glad you had, you know, guardian spirits looking out for you at those moments. And that what a beautiful message. Do not be discouraged. Such a simple phrase, and yet how much it meant. I think this is a great transition point, Amit, maybe to open it up to the Q&A.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to kind of jump in and ask a question myself. Susan, thank you so much, first of all. It's just incredible hearing part of your story and you giving us your time this morning. You know, in thinking about working with individuals that are deaf, you know, the thought that came to my mind was, you know, how does that impact your own ability to listen? And in two ways. One, just because you have to bring a certain mindfulness, I would assume, to just bringing your full presence to that individual when you're trying to communicate. But then just how would that impact also, you know, when you're talking to, let's say, you or I, or you are probably having a conversation, and how has that impacted your ability to listen? What sort of things might have come up? And then also, you know, somewhat maybe sometimes in that silence, what have you learned about or to listen to yourself as well?
As I mentioned, deaf people introduced me to eye contact and the importance of eye contact and my face, facial expressions, and body movement. And I'll give two examples that with the intense eye gaze that deaf people have, you really have to experience it. It's so different from what even what we do when we are gazing into our maybe when we gaze into our children, our baby's eyes, or our lover's eyes, that comes close. But they have this kind of wonderful tractor beam gaze that that you're right there. And so, yes, that helps me listen. And then the second example is facial expressions and body movement and as part of communication. If I'm listening to your face and your body and my body, then I will be much more active and involved in conversation. And the quick example I wanted to give was that if I'm lost and I ask someone for directions and they say you go down 2 blocks and turn right, and I see that they're moving left with their hand, I will turn left because the body doesn't lie. And they make, and every single time, the body doesn't lie. So deaf people have really helped me listen. I never get lost. I follow people's directions that they give with their hands, not with their words.
Thank you. And I believe Audrey has a question.
Yeah, hi, Susan. This is Audrey. I was curious about when you decided to work with Ildefonso and to try to teach him language. How did you stick with it? Because it, to me, when I think about it, it just sounds like something, to do something like that day in and day out isn't easy, especially something as frustrating as trying to communicate without a means to communicate. So I'm curious, now, what drove you to show up every day?
I didn't see that for years and years. And a director who wanted to make a film, he was asking me questions once, and he was asking me personal questions and questions about my childhood and all kinds of things. And I looked at him and I said, "What are you asking these things for?" And he said, "I want to know who you are and why you did this." And I was shocked by that because I thought, well, I thought I did what anybody would do. I just thought I couldn't walk away from somebody not having language. How could a human being not have language? And I really, truly always thought that people would stop if somebody was on the street hurt. They would help them get up. You know, I mean, I thought it was the same kind of thing. And through his questions, I saw that I was born, this has to do with a lack of confidence. I was born into a zoo of a family, 6 kids, and I'm at the tail end, fifth of six. And my younger sister and I were pretty much ignored at the dinner table. And I had never seen this until that man started asking questions, that for a couple years of my young life, my sister and I invented a nonsensical non-language just to try to get attention. And I even remember the name. We called it Samikosiko. And we go, Samikosiko, that was, you know, it was just nonsense. But we would say it in loud, loud voice with normal intonation, and nobody ever noticed. And I think it went on for about 2 years. And I thought, oh, my goodness, I was languageless. Not as bad off as Ildefonso and not as isolated, but it was horrible to be ignored at the dinner table. So at the dinner table, my younger sister and I were languageless. And I had one step closer to being empathetic. And we all feel isolated and alienated at certain times. But, you know, back to Amit's last question, it's like the more we listen to ourselves and realize that this makes us feel isolated or this makes us feel disconnected, the more we can be empathetic to disconnected people in the world.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Beautiful, beautiful story. I think of, you know, this is a little bit of a jump, but I was just thinking back to that first meeting with you at Karma Kitchen, and then the second meeting, I think you came 2 Sundays in a row, and between the first and the second time you came, you had given away your car and were walking everywhere, and had just, there was just talk about paying it forward. You did that in such an incredible way. Right away, you kind of seemed to really get what was going on, and I'd love to hear a little bit about what that experience was like from your end, you know, what brought you there, and what happened after that.
Oh, I'm a little bit sorry that you brought that up, because I was just going to ignore that story. I've told Nipun twice that he got the story wrong, but
oh my goodness.
But
oh, I'm
but
sorry.
It's interesting though, because giving up my car did relate to Karma Kitchen, but it was the other way around. I gave up my car and I was so happy. I drove my car to the dump and gave up driving and gave up a car, and I started walking and taking the bus, and it felt immediately community building, because I'd be seeing people face to face. I saw my neighbors more, and so I was excited about it. I was telling people about it, and I was just saying, I'm so happy. This is so wonderful. I love seeing people on the streets, and I'm seeing more friends and people. And because I was sharing that with lots of people for a couple of weeks, somebody I don't know that well, she sent me a notice about Karma Kitchen opening up that coming Sunday in North Berkeley. And she sent it to me because of the car story, because she knew, because I was talking about community building. And so it actually happened that way around. So I had just given up my car, and that's why I found out about Karma Kitchen.
That's an even better story.
So we affect each other. We always affect each other. This woman isn't a close friend, but she knew because of my car story that I would be interested in Karma Kitchen. And so I show up at Karma Kitchen, and the part of the story that's true is that the first time I took a bus, and then because of just being inspired to do more, I walked the next couple Sundays, which isn't so hard 3 miles downhill, it's just hard 3 miles uphill on the way home. So part of the story is true.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. And what was your kind of your first experience there like?
Well, it was meeting Richard Whitaker the very first Sunday, meeting Poncho the very first Sunday. It was quite full. It was like coming home, because my father was a very generous man, and he didn't see it as generous. He definitely taught me at some level anyway. He taught me that we are not alone, and there's no such thing as being alone. And so I was raised with the most dramatic, because my father found a starving man under the bushes one night, and he brought Fritz home, and Fritz was a German World War One fighter pilot, you know, the Red Baron that Snoopy fights.
Wow.
And so Fritz, this old man, lived with us for 3 months, and there was never, we from an immigrant family that practiced old European traditions, and so that meant Christmas Eve was celebrated. And Christmas Eve that night, there was never a time that I can remember that there weren't strangers in our house. My father couldn't stand the idea of anyone being alone at Christmas Eve, and so we had servicemen that were stationed away from their families. We had young couples who maybe had their first baby and first time they celebrated Christmas, so they were there. We had all kinds of people,
wow.
Old people, all kinds of people in our home. And so he taught me really that we have to share ourselves, because we're connected to everyone else.
What a beautiful, beautiful spirit. And I think I remember seeing recently a beautiful piece that you had written about your father, who would have been 90, I think, last week.
He would have been 90 last Sunday.
Yes, yes, and just the grace and the courage with which he lived his last days. You seem to have taken a lot of his spirit into your own life.
And what is most relevant to me these days is realizing how much we have to grow to even understand stories. It's back to, question about listening, that active listening is not just, paying attention to what the person's saying, but really trying to learn from another person. And I feel like it took me decades to understand a lot of things that my father told me, that we have to grow into stories, and how that relates to not discriminating against any one kind of person or any one language is that we don't even know what gifts we can receive. And if that person who has nothing in common with us on the surface is maybe smelly and ugly and whatever, and we shut that person out, we don't even know what we're losing.
Wow. It's so true. It's so true. Amit, I think we have another caller in the queue, as well as we do want to make sure to get to Zach and have him share about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I go to the heart of the bay.
Thank you, Amit. This is Prakash. I have a quick question. I was really deeply moved by your sharing, and particularly when you said nobody is a human alone, and embracing this these people as an asset rather than looking at them as a liability. My question is around that aspect. I was curious to know your piece of advice for all of us, how we can, as a community, how we can empower ourselves to receive these people, to make them in our everyday life, to make them feel at home in our interactions.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that question. I have been amazed when I go to the State School for the Deaf in Fremont, and I go periodically and I see plays by the little kids, middle school kids, high school kids, all different ages, or I go to adult shows by deaf people. And I'm always amazed because they, again, this shows the genius of seeing that they have, that they see so much better than we do, we hearing people. So one of the easiest and entertaining ways is to look up deaf entertainers, the National Theater of the Deaf. Every country has something. It could be a troupe. It could be like in Eastern Europe, they have a tradition of clowning, and a lot of clowns are deaf. And pantomime, of course, deaf people would be good at pantomime. And that, so in Eastern Europe, that's pretty common. But wherever you are, to find in a school for the deaf, to go to the local programs and learn from deaf people, and to show appreciation for their visual art is a good start. I mean, it's an easy start. And to bring hearing kids to see them and to invite deaf kids to perform or to interact with hearing kids, it's just the worlds are so divided. It's unbelievable how divided they are. And here we sign to our hearing kids now, and 90%, over 90% of doctors in the United States and Canada say, do not sign to your deaf baby if you have a deaf baby. So one of the things that you can do to help deaf people a lot is to talk to your doctors. I would suggest talking to pediatricians because they see the whole baby more than other doctors, and pediatricians might be able to talk to the surgeons that are holding the scalpels. They're not evil. They just think, oh, I can cure deafness. And they don't cure deafness, and they're not thinking about language and socialization. And to say, well, you can still do cochlear implants, you can still do the surgery, but encourage parents to sign to their deaf babies. So promoting sign language as a beautiful language is one thing to do. Just say it to study American Sign Language or whatever country you're in, to study the local language, the signed language, is the biggest way you could help integrate deaf people, to show an interest, even if you just say thank you and hello and I love you.
That's beautiful. I'm going to actually turn it back to Bubby, and our next caller in the queue, I believe, is Zach.
Wonderful. And we just wanted to go back to that bookmark that we placed in the conversation when Susan and I were talking. And she had mentioned that Zach had actually met and interacted with Ildefonso and could provide us some insight into what he's like today.
Sure. I had this opportunity to meet this man, and I had read the interview with Susan in Works and Conversations. It's a very funny connection because I teach at LSU, and I also went to school at LSU, and well, this is the last class I ever took was with Richard Whitaker's brother, John Whitaker.
Oh, my goodness.
And the class was class on contemplative prayer and meditation, which is really funny. And it was a great class. It was a great way to end my 4 years at LSU. And then some years later, I find myself back teaching at LSU and reconnecting with John Whitaker. And one day his brother was in town and we met. He gave me a copy of the magazine to take home and read. And in that copy was the story. And I read it over and over. I was just totally, totally blown away. I mean, as everybody is when they hear it, you know, I was really moved. So moved, and I imagined all kinds of things about this man. I had all sorts of ideas in my head, and I had ended up speaking with Susan eventually, and then making a trip to California, and we met. Susan and I met for the first time, so that was great. But we'd already had the opportunity to speak, and I'd read the interview and listened to some interview on the radio as well, and you know, not having had any way to communicate with Ildefonso, and you know, signing and deafness are things that were just never ever a part of anything I ever thought about. And you know, meeting the man versus, you know, hearing about him and reading about him was such a that's where it really became the stark difference between language and experience, and experience of another person in the, you know, physical space is just such a profound made a profound impact on me. And you know, specifically, what to say about him is always going to be a you know, some kind of reduction. Such a generous man, and I think someone else earlier in the conversation, much earlier, said that in order for there to be givers, there need to be receivers, and somehow whatever happened between Susan and Ildefonso was this, that was happening, you know, back in that classroom. And something about him was he was so giving with just his attention and his kind of observation, ability to observe things, and such a generous man. I mean, I felt like I got to know him in a way without ever being able to say anything, which is a very odd. I've never had that experience before. But he is such a generous man, and we went back there this summer and made a short film with him, and you know, he spent 2 days with us, you know, traveling around San Diego, and you know, not quite understanding why we wanted to make a film about him, but sort of having the faith that that it was something worth doing. And I don't know, it was just to see someone that is so willing to participate in these kind of interactions without, you know, being able to have a full storytelling ability to share stories the way we can, the way that we do. Because of course he can, but in a very different way. It changed me in a lot of ways too. Something I'm grateful to have had the experience of, and looking forward to continuing that story in a film.
Thank you, Zach. It's just incredible to see how all the dots connect and all the different interconnections that brought each of us in contact with each other. And I think everyone on this call in some small way has been changed by this conversation. I think we are getting close to the end, Susan, but before we do our close, I wanted to ask what is it that the rest of us can do to support the wonderful work that you're doing and to help amplify your voice?
I've been hoping to use the new edition of the book and the film project as a tool for community building. And last summer I worked with somebody on getting a new website, and I explained to her I do not want to follow the formula. The formula is it's supposed to be about me, and it's supposed to be about book promotion, and you know, buy the book, and and me. And I said, I don't want that. I want it to be about the subject of community building, about connection, about storytelling, that we do affect each other and we are all connected. And just saying that, she came up with this beautiful logo, an open book, and then at the bottom it says Susan Schaller et al. And so I have projects that I'm working on, and then I have a column et al., and that includes all of you. I mean, anybody who works with me. So what I'd like to do, what I am doing, is going into a community, and it might look the same. I might give a book talk. But what I'm trying to do is go behind the scenes and maybe introduce a librarian with an elementary school teacher, and they're actually doing the same thing, the same passion for literacy or something, and so strengthen ties that do exist, or make ties in that community, and so be a catalyst. And if my book and or the film project could be used for a joint fundraiser for an education project or for a community project, that's what I would love to do. A lot of joint teamwork and building a team, and the theme, which is reality, that we are not fully human alone. It's also true with our work. It shouldn't be so individualistic. And I would love to completely follow the gift economy. I do give books away. However, I have no income other than my savings, and so if anyone has any ideas on how I can use the book and the film for community building, but at the same time paying rent, a transition problem, or what, any ideas at all, I'm very, very open. The website is susanschaller.com. And so you can contact me through there or through POVI,
Service Space, that's right, yeah.
I'm sorry, I realized I was putting the old one and the new one together, servicespace.org. So I would love ideas. It's all, to me, it's about team building as part of community building. And Zach and I will be doing some touring at film festivals. Hopefully the short film will be accepted, and we're trying to build momentum and get resources to have a full-length documentary. And we don't have any resources for that, so we could use some help. We're volunteering and paying out of pocket, and hopefully we'll get launched somehow.
I'm sure your story proves over and over again, where there's a will, there's the way will be cleared. So we will definitely be doing a write-up on this call, sharing it through the blog. The audio will be up, and we will send out links to all the callers as well, so that they can continue to stay connected. Thank you, Susan, so much for not just being on this call, but for the passionate commitment that you have for this field and for the communities all over the world that are touched and will be touched by the work that you are doing. It really, I think, has been such an opportunity for each one of us listening to you to deepen in our understanding of, you know, the blessing of language and the power of listening and the many different lessons that we can learn from each other, and not looking at not just deafness, but any of these so-called handicaps, not as limitations, but as really a profoundly different way of looking out onto the world that has its own unique place and role to play. Thank you for that window that you provided to all of us. What we're going to do now is a couple of minutes in silence, just giving gratitude for the work that you've done, for all the people who have championed this work, all the people who are communicators of the deepest languages of humanity. And then at the end of that, Amit will unmute all the callers, and we will have a moment where we can all express our gratitude. What is the sign for thank you?
It's your hand is flat, like if you take your open hand and then close all your fingers. So it's an open hand, but your fingers are closed, and the palm is facing towards you, and you put the tips of your finger near your mouth, the tips of your fingers, so your fingers are pointing up, palm in, and then you start at your chin, and then you just bring it down. You just bend your elbow, bring it down, and that's thank you. And it's not quite universal, but it's almost universal.
Okay, all right. So we will, at the end of our 2 minutes of silence, we will do a vocal thank you, and those of us inspired will do the sign as well. Thank you for that gift.